From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Sarah Zaman, anchor and reporter for VOA's Urdu service. Our guest on this edition of the program is Alex Fatanka, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and author of the new book, Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. Alex Fatanka is a leading expert on Iranian domestic and foreign affairs, Iranian security forces, and U.S.-Iranian relations. He has been a frequent guest on our Encounter program on these very issues. A native of Tehran, Alex previously worked as a senior Middle East analyst at Jane's Defense and Security Group in London. His recent book, Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence, analyzes the close yet complex relationship between Iran and Pakistan, nations with a combined population of 300 million, and strategic partners since Pakistan's first days as a fledgling state. Iran was the first country to recognize Pakistan's independence in 1947, and the Shah of Iran was the first head of state to visit the new nation. As the U.S. focus on the region increases, Alex Fatanka asks if the neighborly cooperation is fueled by cultural or religious bonds or is more of a reaction to the West. Here to analyze the evolution of the Tehran-Islamabad partnership from the 1700s to date is the author and expert himself, Alex Fatanka. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Sarah Zaman.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, Alex, as I said in the introduction, you've been on our Encounter program. Now you're the sole guest. You're in the hot seat. We're delighted you're back to talk about this book. Talk briefly about the historical and cultural ties that long predate Iran's recognition of Pakistan's independence from India. Talk about the deep affinity between Persia, as Iran was known historically, and the Mughal Empire of the subcontinent.
Thank you very much. You know, when I was looking at this topic, I had to keep in mind that when you look at Iran's relations with 15 of its immediate neighbors, the largest country that seems not to have been explored in detail is the country of Pakistan. And in reality, it's a country that Iran has had good relations with to begin with. Certainly when Pakistan emerged as a nation state, there was a lot of hope and belief that Tehran and Pakistan could become not just strategic allies against the then Soviet threat from the north, but to actually build on something bigger. There was all sorts of talking going on between the Shah of Iran, who took over in 1941, and successive Pakistani leaders. And in many ways, things were really working out well. If you look at the history from 47 till about the early 70s, Iran looks to Pakistan as not just a buffer zone, but something greater than that, a partner of sorts that can help Iran, not just in the realm of security, but also a country that could work with Iran in the realm of economics and so forth. But as the Shah looks at Pakistan's focus being solely on India, he starts having doubts in the Pakistanis as a valuable ally, because Pakistan's bigger fight with India, in the eyes of the Shah, was always going to be a drag on everything else that Pakistan did in the region, including Pakistan's relations with Iran. So if you look at the totality of history between Iran and Pakistan, you got the first couple of decades characterized by closeness, and oftentimes it was one driven by personalities. Pakistani leaders tended to visit the Shah frequently, and the Shah would return the favor and go to Pakistan. But as these two countries mature in the sort of post-Second World War world, you see Iran increasingly looking to the Arab world for both opportunities, but also a place where threats might come from. And the Pakistanis increasingly are entangled with the big neighbor to their east called India.
Talk about the relationship after the revolution, after 1979. How did things change?
Before I started working on the book project, one of the things I would come across again and again is that the Iranian Revolution of 1979 changed everything. Reality, as my research showed, is more complicated than that. Relations between Iran and Pakistan started suffering as early as 1971. Immediately after the Pakistan-India War of 71, the Shah of Iran decides that we need to look at Pakistan as a strategic liability. The fall of Bangladesh in the eyes of the Shah was something that could be repeated again in Pakistan. He feared that Pakistani province of Balochistan would break away. What would happen if Pakistan fragmented further? What would happen if the Soviets were meddling in Pakistan and creating mini communist client states in what was Pakistan? So the point is, Shah had already started thinking about Pakistan differently about a decade before he was actually toppled by the mullahs in 1979. Now, when the mullahs come to power in 1979, they look at Pakistan as an important Muslim country. And yet, the man who led the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, basically has no time for the Pakistani leader and General Ziaul-Haq. He looks at Ziaul-Haq as an American client. He doesn't believe Ziaul-Haq as a companion in this path of creating alternatives to the Western and the Eastern worlds then dominated by the Soviet Union. And the Pakistanis who visited Khomeini kind of come back, and if you read what they say is, these people have just taken over in Tehran. They don't know what they're doing. It's all just basically a pipe dream. To some extent, the Pakistanis were right. But that doesn't take away from the fact that Ziaul-Haq was excited to see the Shah fall in 1979. Because he genuinely believed that a country the size of Iran could become an important partner in Pakistan's struggle against India. Now, both the Iranians and the Pakistanis, as history shows, kind of misread one another clearly. But what is important in all this is to remember it was not the revolution of 1979 that was the groundbreaking moment and took us to where we are today, where relations are at best lukewarm. It's something more strategic and happened when the Shah was still around and has to do with where the Iranians and Pakistanis look to when they are basically formulating their foreign policy. What are their key priorities? For the Pakistanis, at least in the eyes of the Iranians, has always been India. And for the Pakistanis, Iran could have done a lot more for them than it has done historically. So I think that's where we are today.
All right. Let me turn to my colleague, Sarah, for a question.
So one of the things I want to go back to is that you said that Iran actually started to distance itself from Pakistan because it saw that Pakistan was solely worried about India, but that Iran was also looking at its Arab partners for opportunities. But when we look at the world in the current situation, Iran and the Arab world are actually presented as traditional rivals. And Pakistan and Iran are presented as traditional allies. Even though in Pakistan you have a majority of Sunnis and in Iran you have a majority of Shias. In your opinion, what kind of a role has religion played in Iran and Pakistan's relationship, and even in Iran's relationship then with India and with the Arab world? Has religion been important, or for Pakistan and Iran, geopolitical realities and this desire to have some kind of strategic control of affairs in the region been more important than religion itself?
You know, when I did my research for the book, in all the hundreds and hundreds of documents, declassified British, American, and other cables that I had access to, the word Sunni and Shia came up maybe a handful of times. It was not a factor. This sectarian fight is a relatively new phenomenon in Pakistani society. It comes in the late 1970s, and let's not kid ourselves, is largely foreign-driven, if not financed. The Gulf Arab states have been guilty in this, and Iran has been guilty in this. Throughout the 1980s, when the revolutionary euphoria in Iran was still running strong, the Iranians wouldn't even hide the fact that they were supporting revolutionary Shia groups in Pakistan and helping create a fertile ground for sectarian violence. But the fact is, if you look at the large Pakistani society today, about 190 million people, the actors that are playing this violent sectarian game are on the margins of society, even though it's a much of a bigger issue today than it's ever been. The idea that religion was a major shaping factor is one that I don't subscribe to. I think outsiders and certain individuals within these societies in Pakistan have tried to politicize religion for their own gains. But it's not a deep issue. I don't think it's a message that resonates across this strong and large country of Pakistan. But nonetheless, it's been used as a tool in the hands of the few, and oftentimes with deadly consequences, as we've witnessed so many times in the last few years. To your point about the geopolitics, look, Pakistan, since 1979, has had to make a basic decision and calculation. What's the Islamic Republic of Iran's value for Pakistan? What can Iran bring to the table in the fight against India? What can Iran do in terms of helping the Pakistanis with their finances? What can Iran do in terms of supply of weaponry? And if you go down the list, clearly on the major issues like the supply of arms and being a diplomatic supporter of Pakistan, Iran, the Islamic Republic, since 1979, can't deliver much. Now, imagine Pakistan today has a couple millions of expatriates working across the Gulf region. These people send billions of dollars home. If Pakistan tomorrow decided to side with Iran in the Iranian-Saudi rivalry, say, it could risk those billions of dollars that are coming into the country every year. Why would it do that? At the same time, why would it do what, for instance, Saudi Arabia is asking Pakistan to do by sending troops to Yemen to fight the Saudi fight? So they're in a bit of a pickle. They have to sit on the fence. They have to make sure that they don't side with either of these two rivals in the region, Iran and the Saudis. And in the best of circumstances, basically make the most of it. And it has worked in the past for them, and it might work again. One thing Pakistan cannot afford to do is to let its ground, its soil, its people become tools in this sectarian fight that is brewing in the region, because Pakistan would be the one that will pay the highest price for it should it come to that.
I also want to go back to another thing that you mentioned, the foreign influence. Before the Soviets arrived in Afghanistan in 1978, Pakistan was again, even culturally, more aligned with the Persian culture than with the Arab culture. But once the Soviet forces are there, with U.S. and Saudi help, the Mujahideen are funded and a lot of money pours in from Saudi Arabia into Pakistan. How do you think that shifted Pakistan's own society and culture and turned it into an entity that's so different and has become so much more complicated for either Iran or for Saudi Arabia to have a relationship with? And even now, Pakistan, as you said, is in a bit of a pickle because it's not in a position to pick sides anymore. Right. So talk a little bit about the shift in culture that you see post-Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
You know, clearly the Pakistani involvement in the fight against the Soviet Union by using the Mujahideen, both obviously the Afghan Mujahideen, which made the bulk of it, but also the many foreign fighters, the thousands that ended up traveling from around the world to fight in this fight against the communists, had this byproduct. And that byproduct is a new and much more violent version of Islam. Hawkish, intolerant version of Islam that Pakistani society hasn't historically been used to. And I think a lot of people regret that fact. I learned perhaps this when I was in one of my trips to Pakistan, to give you just a very simple example and yet telling example, since you brought up the issue of Persian culture in Pakistan, and good parts of today's Pakistan historically have been part of what we call the Persian Empire, you know, and the names of cities and towns and things are testified to the fact that the Persian influence has been there historically and continues to be there. But in Pakistan, for instance, I heard the word Allah Hafiz, which means goodbye. In certain circles in Pakistan, instead of saying Khuda Hafiz, which is the Persian version, they would say Allah Hafiz. And I thought, I've never heard Allah Hafiz. What does that mean? And they would say, well, you know, with the Arab influence that came in the 80s, they wouldn't use the word Khuda, which is a Persian way for God. They use Allah, which is the Arabic version. So you even see this cultural sort of struggle happening on Pakistani soil. And, you know, as I said, many of the Pakistanis that I spoke to were at best very hesitant about this direction that the society is on, and were not sure if this is a process that can be controlled, because we've seen it can easily make a violent turn, and that is not good for Pakistan.
But would you say that international powers like Russia and the U.S., they misunderstood Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan, because they have their interest in the region, these global powers? But the way it actually played out on the ground didn't really help anyone achieve most of what anyone was hoping to achieve. And if at the end of the day, when we see there is more extremism in Pakistan, there's a regime in Iran still that even after the nuclear deal has not really been able to have the kind of relations with the U.S. that one would have in Iran, at least hope for. Did the global powers underestimate and in fact misunderstand these countries?
Well, I mean, if we go back to the 1980s, the global powers, the Soviet Union, the United States at the time, were literally using this as a proxy war. I mean, they were engaged in a conflict for domination in Afghanistan and by some extent through default, Pakistan were instruments in this proxy war for global influence. I don't think we can say that the Pakistanis didn't know what they were doing. I think history will show that certainly General Ziaul Haq was looking at what was happening in Afghanistan as an opportunity. He didn't consider the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan only as a threat. It was an opportunity to move Pakistan closer to the United States. It was an opportunity to say to the American presidents, successive American presidents, that look, I am your ally in a very dangerous part of the world. Arm me. Give me what I ask for, and I will do what the Shah of Iran up till 1979 was promising to do for you, being your basically gendarme in this region. So, you know, this is one of the reasons the Americans, for instance, looked away throughout the 1980s when Pakistan was building up its nuclear capabilities. American intelligence knew full well what Pakistan was doing. But because they needed Pakistan's support in the fight against the Soviets, they decided to look away. And guess what happens? As soon as the Soviets are pretty much telling us that they're withdrawing from Afghanistan, American sanctions on Pakistan on the nuclear issue returned to the debate.
Indeed, and it's important to mention also that India, Pakistan's arch enemy, was allied with, for many years, the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. The Indians made no secret from the fact that they, in many ways, were feeling more affinity for the Soviet Union than the United States.
Indeed. So, of course, this would increase the enmity between Pakistan and India. Well, we'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Alex Vatanka. He's senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and author of Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Sarah Zaman. She's anchor and reporter in VOA's Urdu service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a fan from Bangladesh, Habib Sattar. He currently resides in the UAE. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Alex, and let's fast forward a bit to today's reality, looking at Afghanistan and the fact that the United States recently killed in a U.S. drone strike in Pakistan the former Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansour. And, you know, he was reported to have gone to Iran prior to having returned to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. What interest does Iran have in supporting the Taliban?
Well, I mean, look, he had also gone to Dubai 18 times. His own passport will show, and he'd gone to Iran. Two things we can deduct right away. Iran and Taliban, on paper, should not get along. And in fact, when Taliban was running the show in Afghanistan, did not get along. In 1998, the closest thing that Iran has been to invading another country was Afghanistan under the Taliban when the Iranian diplomats were killed by the Taliban. So on paper, they should not get along. But history also teaches us that the Islamic Republic of Iran can be extremely flexible in choosing tactical partners. And over the last 10, 15 years since the invasion of Afghanistan, there's been credible reports that at least part of the Taliban leadership in Afghanistan has been in contact with the Iranians. There are suggestions that the Iranian state wants to pull away some of the Taliban leadership that in Iran's estimations are too close to the Pakistanis. Basically, what the Iranians are doing is, as they've done elsewhere in the region, places like Iraq and so on, have as many alliances as possible because you cannot know for sure who's going to win at the end of the day, and you want to have maximum amount of influence that you can garner should the United States tomorrow pull out of Afghanistan and Taliban should return to power. Then Iran, I suspect, is their thinking, would want to have somebody that they can talk to and not go back to the 1990s where basically they almost went to war with another.
That's very interesting because in Pakistan also the leadership often says when they are accused of having close relationships with the Afghan Taliban is that the U.S. has the luxury of leaving the region, but we don't. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we're justified in having certain relationships that may seem very controversial or unacceptable for the Americans. But when we talk about the region today, one of the other things is economic cooperation. And we see India investing very heavily in not just Afghanistan, but also in Iran. The Chabahar port that's on the South Asian border of Iran is currently being developed by India. Recently, Prime Minister Modi visited Iran, and there was this plan to spend $500 million to develop that port. And what that port does is it gives Iran, Afghanistan, and India direct access to each other. And especially it gives landlocked Afghanistan a more direct access to India. On the other hand, you also see Pakistan and China working on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, a $46 billion investment in Pakistan by China. So Pakistan goes with China, Iran goes with India. How do you see these two countries, Iran and Pakistan, managing their relationships with these bigger powers in the region?
You know, the first thing to say about what you just described about an Iranian effort to build up its port of Chabahar and the Pakistanis building Gwadar. The tragedy, in my view, is it's a basic classic example of a zero-sum game. It's a competition for influence in a region that is desperately short of economic integration. If you look at the success stories around the world, why is the European Union so strong economically? And if you look at the data, the Europeans, by and large, tend to trade among themselves. In West Asia, I mean, let me give you a specific example. Pakistan is a country of nearly 190 million people. Iran just became a country of 80 million people. Combined, they are a huge market. And yet Iran and Pakistan barely trade one another. There are no direct flights between Iran and Pakistan. You have to go to a place like Dubai to go from Islamabad to Tehran. That just shows you the lack of integration on a whole host of levels. Now, you cannot blame the United States, Russia, or anybody else for that matter for this. This, in my view, is a lack of political foresight, leadership in Tehran and Islamabad, where so much could have happened in terms of trade, cooperation, investment. Again, Pakistan, one of the most desperate, energy-starving countries on the planet. Iran is a global energy power, and yet the Iranians don't have enough market. Why not have that oil and gas go to Pakistan? It takes one simple pipeline, and they've been talking about a pipeline for almost 30 years.
I mean, Iran has been able to build its own part of the pipeline, but Pakistan is still sitting on it. But an interesting thing is that Iran has not invoked the clause in that agreement where if Pakistan had not finished this pipeline by 2014, Pakistan would have had to pay a $3 million a day surcharge. But Iran did not invoke that.
Right, right. No, you know, that is true. But I think that the sort of larger point, I guess, I'm trying to get to is if you have goodwill to integrate, because look, one approach is to say, let's meet as leaders and let's just say bygones are bygones and let's just be friends and we'll start all over again. Turn a page. That, in my view, is unrealistic. You got to have to take practical steps towards the larger but consistent integration. And trade is the easiest thing you can do. Because if you make one another stakeholders in each other's economic well-being, then the political differences become less of a factor as you go forward.
So if I understand then, Alex, it looks like the so-called neighborly relationship between Iran and Pakistan has to some extent deteriorated by virtue of this very
example. New port as well, the Chabahar port and the Gwadar port being developed separately with separate partners. Is that, in your mind, a further indication of sort of less than warm relations?
You know, it is continuation of basically disinterest in one another and part of Pakistan and Iran. The Iranians tend to look at Pakistan basically and look over Pakistan and they're excited about India. And in my view, that's a mistake. Pakistan is large enough and qualifies both as a market and a diplomatic partner that you need to also cultivate Pakistan and not just see Pakistan as simply a piece of land that you need to get over to get to the sort of promised land called India. But Chabahar and Gwadar have been worked on for literally years. Whether they're going to be completed anytime soon is anyone's guess. The $500 million that the Indians just promised during Prime Minister Modi's visit to Tehran is something, or similar figures have been promised in the past. Now, remember, India pulled out of Iran in 2007 as soon as the Iranians came under sanctions, and the Iranians have not forgotten that. So what happens in Chabahar to a large extent depends on whether Iran can stay the course of being part of the international mainstream. If the hardliners in Iran tomorrow should have another Ahmadinejad-type president who speaks a very different language than the current president, Hassan Rouhani, then the Indians are going to be forced to choose between a revolutionary Iran and their interest elsewhere in the world. So much will depend on the evolution of the Islamic Republic. Are they going to make themselves more of a mainstream country, or are they going to sort of basically speak the language of revolutionary change, which frankly doesn't bring a lot of confidence to investors, including countries like India?
And now back to the Iran-Pakistan relationship. We've known historically that Islamabad has provided Tehran with valuable nuclear know-how. And now we, of course, have the so-called nuclear deal between the P5 plus one and Iran to curb Iran's nuclear program. How does that deal affect Iran-Pakistan relations?
When I was in Pakistan, former officials, present officials who I spoke to will quietly tell you, look, we don't like anyone in our neighborhood going nuclear. But at the same time, we don't feel that an Iranian nuclear program is aimed at us. Pakistan looks at its border with Iran as probably the least hot border they have. I mean, if you look at what they have to go through, the Pakistanis on their border with Afghanistan and India, what they have on the Iranian border is relatively quiet. And it's been quiet for a very long time. And I guess what they were telling me is the nuclear issue is not going to change that. Now, I think when I look at Pakistan's relations with Iran today, geopolitically, the biggest challenge is the Arab question. And, you know, Pakistan is forced to have to choose. So far, it's decided not to make the kind of decision that, for instance, Saudi Arabia has been asking for. I mean, earlier this year, Deputy Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and the Foreign Minister of Saudi Arabia made official high-level visit to Islamabad with that on the agenda. Choose us over Iran. I think that's going to remain the big challenge for Pakistan, but I suspect they're going to be able to keep themselves out of this fight between Iran and Saudi Arabia to the extent that it's possible.
So in terms of trust building, what would you suggest? Because right now, in Pakistan at least, you have a leadership that's, even though has been able to sort of not pick sides, we know that the Nawaz Sharif government and family has historically been very close to the Saudi monarchy. What do you see necessary on the ground in terms of concrete steps for trust building between Iran and Pakistan?
I've heard in my visits to the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, places like United Arab Emirates and Qatar, that Pakistan might be a candidate should Iran and the likes of Saudi Arabia decide to open a chapter of dialogue, that the Pakistanis could be mediating efforts of that nature. And when Nawaz Sharif was in Tehran, he actually publicly said that was something Pakistan was willing to do. Whether the Iranians trust the Pakistanis to be given that role, that's a whole open question. As you pointed out, Nawaz Sharif, someone who lived in Saudi Arabia a long time, who I believe has some of his children married into the Saudi society. I'm not sure that needs to be confirmed. But nonetheless, the Saudis and Nawaz Sharif are very close, and I wonder if that's not an issue that might concern the Iranians. But if there are countries out there that need to mediate between Iran and its rival Arab states, the question for Pakistan is it worth their energy to get involved in this? Because at this moment in time, it seems like a losing argument, that Iran and the Arab states of the Persian Gulf are so far afield from one another that mediation is not looking very good.
What about Iran as some kind of a mediator between Pakistan and India, given its excellent relations, or relatively good relations, as we see through trade and economic cooperation with India and even Afghanistan?
Frankly, Carol, I think you have exactly the same dynamics at play, just on the Pakistani side. The Pakistanis don't trust Iran. The Pakistanis feel that Iran is simply too close to India. Some Pakistani officials will even go far, say Iranian Balochistan that borders Pakistan has been given basically open grounds to the Indian intelligence services to penetrate Pakistan from. So again, it's an issue of trust. I don't think the Pakistanis would want Iran's very good relations with India at this moment to sort of be utilized. They don't think this is the best way forward.
All right. Well, so much for our attempts at diplomacy. The book is Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. The author, Alex Vatanka. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. Alex, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your insights about your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jackson Witt. And joining me on the program was Sarah Zaman, anchor and reporter in VOA's Urdu service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.